Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the program today, technology stocks and equal pay, but not, of course, in the same story. And from one of the people who built Pixar Studios, the secret of making good movies. It's so simple, yet so very, very hard. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 7th of April. Great to have you here, everybody. I just wish I had a warmer welcome for you stock market-wise. Ugly is too strong a word, as is tech bubble, to be sure. But clearly, there is something afoot in the NASDAQ. The, repeat after me because we've all heard it before, tech-heavy index dropped more than 2.5% on Friday. Another 1.2% today. And yes, I am the one who always says the stock market is not the economy and the economy is not the markets. But just this once, humor me. Let's play that out. What do you think it means for the broader economy when tech stocks seem to be in trouble? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going with that.
Does anyone remember when Homer Simpson created a tech company?
Compute Global Hyper Meganet.
That episode aired during the tech bubble of the late 90s.
What exactly is it your company does again?
Oh, this industry moves so fast, it's really hard to tell.
We are far from the days of the tech bubble, but it is a question you can still ask. The tech sector gets a lot of attention, but what does it really do for the economy? By one rough estimate, it employs maybe 1.3 million people. But that's out of 138 million employed people in the U.S. But still, its impact is much wider than that.
What the tech sector historically has done and continues to do today is come up with new ways of doing business for all companies in all industries, in addition to cool technology innovations as well.
This is Matt Slaughter. He teaches economics at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business.
The benefits of that innovation tend to accrue throughout the entire economy.
One way an economy becomes more productive is through new technology, and the tech sector kind of embodies that. So does the fact that tech stocks are taking a hit signify a major problem under the hood with our economic engine?
You know, not unusual.
Stuart Freeman is chief equity strategist with Wells Fargo Advisors. He says tech stocks did well over the past year, and people just wanted to cash out.
After a while, you started to see investors take a little bit of profits in the meat of the tech sector, some of the larger companies.
And that kind of nudged other investors to do the same thing. And because some tech companies are ultimately pretty small, it doesn't take much movement among investors to rock their boat, if you will.
Those stocks can move faster.
And he says this wasn't a crash. Friday was bad, but most tech stocks are only down between 0.7 and 1% over the year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The presidential pen is going to have a busy couple of days. President Obama wants to close the pay gap between men and women. So tomorrow he's going to sign an executive order that'll ban federal contractors from punishing workers who talk about what they're getting paid. He's also going to order the Labor Department to come up with some rules to make those same contractors provide data on how much their employees are making, broken down by race and by gender. The orders, it is worth a note here, will apply only to federal contractors, but as Marketplace's Noel King reports, that is no small group of people.
Companies with federal contracts employ around 26 million people in the U.S. Sam Estreicher, who directs the Center for Labor and Employment Law at NYU Law School, jokes that federal contractor is basically a synonym
for multinational corporations, for U.S.-based multinationals. A lot of the major companies, they do something with the federal government.
Their employees work in defense and aerospace, food service, and housekeeping. It's unclear how Obama's executive order will define who is a federal contractor, says Jeffrey Hirsch, a professor at the University of North Carolina School of Law. Typically, he says, there are exceptions.
For instance, if you were on a military base and you had folks that worked in the kitchen or the food service area through a contractor, those employees would be affected by an executive order.
But the men and women who work in the warehouse that provides the potatoes, Hirsch says they're probably not going to be covered. He says a lot of what's in the executive order, like letting employees talk freely about what they're paid, is already law.
Wage discrimination based on sex and other factors is already illegal and has been since the 60s. And so really what the president's executive order is looking to do is to try to bring some of that discrimination to light.
Transparency is also why contractors will have to provide earnings data by race and gender. Sam Estreicher says the data will need to be specific.
If you're telling me that, you know, men and women at this 5,000-person company are getting paid a certain amount, I don't know what to do with that data. If you tell me that Harry, Dick, and Mary, who are doing precisely the same work I am doing, are getting paid more, I'm going to start raising a ruckus.
The ruckus that some are expecting could come in the form of lawsuits. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
There was indeed a ruckus on Wall Street today, a ruckus of the selling variety. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are places in this country where stories of foreclosure are sadly not rare. Florida, Las Vegas, parts of Southern California, in fact. Not so much Maryland, but there is a second wave of foreclosures upon us. States where the foreclosure process was delayed are having a big spike. Maryland, in fact, has the second highest foreclosure rate in the country at the moment. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes it from there.
The townhouse Robert Witherspoon lives in a quiet cul-de-sac in Prince George's County, Maryland. Witherspoon greets me as I drive up, telling me he's lived here for about 10 years.
We really love it here.
The brick townhouse is solidly built, like Witherspoon, a 52-year-old Navy veteran.
I've been in Iraq.
Now that he's retired from the Navy, Witherspoon works from home, managing a small IT company. He shows me in and gives me a tour.
Okay, this is, as you say, we just left the kitchen.
Witherspoon leads me from the kitchen through the dining room to the living room, which he says his 8-year-old son claims as his territory. There aren't too many toys lying around, though. Most of them are strewn around his son's room upstairs. This house is lived in, but it was sold in a foreclosure auction last September. Witherspoon says his bank bought the house. He hasn't paid his mortgage in a couple of years.
I've been very blessed, without a doubt, that I'm still in my home today.
Witherspoon first fell behind on his mortgage payments when he was laid off in 2009. Now he's basically squatting. Actually, that's not so unusual. At one point, while banks were negotiating a national settlement, they stopped foreclosing in some states. And still, the average foreclosure in Maryland takes almost 2 years. That's because Maryland requires foreclosures to be approved by a judge, and new laws slowed things down even more by allowing things like mediation.
The longer process has definitely helped.
That's Lisa Butler McDougall. She's executive director of Sowing Empowerment and Economic Development, or SEED, a group that helps homeowners avoid foreclosure. Butler McDougall says foreclosures in Maryland used to be rushed.
Some people's homes are being foreclosed in 15 days, 30 days, where before they could even understand the notice of intent to foreclose, they were receiving notice of a sheriff's sale.
Manny Montero is an attorney who represents homeowners in foreclosures. He says, yes, the delays do help some people, but others just need to get out of their houses fast.
There's so many people that come in here that have medical issues as a result of the stress of trying to hold on to a house that isn't worth it.
Montero says many homeowners don't realize that living rent-free in a foreclosed house could eventually cost them because it makes it much tougher for them to file for bankruptcy and wipe out their debts, something Montero frequently tells his clients to do.
You know, at some point, you need to stop making decisions with your heart and start making decisions with your mind. And those are the come-to-Jesus type conversations that I have with homeowners every day.
Back in his townhouse, Robert Witherspoon says he didn't want to file for bankruptcy. He says he tried to start up his mortgage payments again, but couldn't because the bank wanted a lump sum first, which he didn't have. Witherspoon's bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, wouldn't comment, except to say it made several attempts to reach out to him. Now Witherspoon is afraid he'll get an eviction notice.
So every day's an adventure when I go to my mailbox, because you never know. I never know what they're going to say.
Witherspoon says he plans to move after the end of the school year. He certainly doesn't want to get evicted, especially since that happened to him as a teenager.
When you're in high school and you come home and you see your bed outside the house and not in the house, and I was totally embarrassed by that.
Of course, Witherspoon says his current situation is embarrassing too, but even after the pain of foreclosure, he still wants to someday buy again. In Prince George's County, Maryland, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's a certain ritual to grocery shopping, right? You check the fridge and the pantry, you make your list, you go to the store, you realize you've forgotten your list, and so you wing it as you wander the aisles aimlessly. Enter now, as in so many facets of our lives, Amazon and a new gizmo, I guess, a wand, basically, that's a handheld barcode reader and voice recorder all in one that lets you enter your shopping lists or scan items already on your shelves, all in the service of letting us buy more from Amazon, of course. The Dash, this thing is called, is supposed to make the Amazon Fresh delivery service easier to use, which is great, but so many online retailers have tried and failed in the seemingly low-tech business of delivering milk and bread because, I don't know why. Sally Herships has this one.
They can figure out how to send your computer cookies, so why can't e-commerce companies deliver the real kind to your door?
Because it's not what high-tech companies do well.
Len Lotish teaches marketing at Wharton. He says, think about packing a grocery bag with milk, eggs, and bread.
So it's figuring out what in the package do you need to do so when it's on the truck, it doesn't slosh around or get broken or push down if it's bread.
That's before you even tackle that whole pesky temperature issue, you know, keeping food safe to eat.
And so why have grocery stores succeeded at this?
Because they know how to do that.
Unlike the failed online delivery service Webvan, which is infamous in entrepreneurial circles.
They tried to expand too fast. They tried to do it all at once and ran out of money very quickly.
David McGoldrick is an analyst with Euromonitor International. He says the profit margin on groceries is tiny. There's not a lot of room for error, especially for a startup. Then we're back to delivery again. Tech companies are great at delivery, but McGoldrick says not necessarily at the right speed for, say, 4 sticks of butter.
You usually want it later that day or as early as possible the next day.
McGoldrick says delivery companies would have to have huge and pricey infrastructure in place to get you your butter on time. But investment research for Morningstar says Amazon is already set up with warehouses, trucks, and fulfillment centers. If the company can figure out how to pack your groceries, it could stand to make a lot of bread. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, high-tech creativity from Pixar.
It's not about the technology. It's about the story. And if we ever get those two inverted, we would get screwed up.
Content is king. Remember that, you guys. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 166 points today. 1% closed at 16,245, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 47 points, the aforementioned 1 1/10 or so percent, as I said, ending things at 4,079. The S&P 500 lurched 20 points lower, 1%, 1845 there. Earnings season opens tomorrow with results from Alcoa. The company's shares melted 1% today. The first quarterly reports from banks come later in the week. Investors prepared by selling across the board. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan both fell more than 1%. Bank of America down 2% today. World Wrestling Entertainment got clotheslined, fell more than 14% after investors said the company hasn't attracted enough subscribers to its streaming service. Can't imagine why there. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.69%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its monthly job openings and labor turnover survey. The Senate Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry Committee holds a hearing on advanced biofuels, creating jobs and lower prices at the pump. And I know it's only the beginning of the week, but let's talk about beer. The Craft Brewers Conference and Brew Expo America gets underway in Denver. About 7,000 attendees are expected. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Regional Transportation Authority in Chicago, which covers basically northeastern Illinois, says it's been cheated out of hundreds of millions of dollars over the past 15 years, a penny or two at a time. The culprits are towns out beyond the suburbs, places like Kankakee and Sycamore, and the dozens of companies the agency says have used those towns as tax havens. We're talking companies like Target and AT&T, American Airlines, and some smaller ones, too. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
MTS Consulting keeps an office in a faceless little building off Schuyler Avenue in Kankakee, about an hour south of Chicago. When no one answers, I look in the mail slot. I don't see a phone on the desk. I don't see a computer on the desk. Down the hall, I ask a woman at Pinnacle Opportunities about MTS.
Have you ever met anybody who's been there?
I haven't, sorry.
How long have you been working here?
We've been here over a year.
Over a year?
Chicago's Regional Transportation Authority says MTS records significant sales here on behalf of clients based in the Chicago area. And it's one of several companies with offices like this in towns like Kankakee. They're here to save on sales tax. Illinois sets a statewide sales tax, but in Chicago, the tax is higher because it adds levies for the city and the county and the RTA. Carol Portman runs the Illinois Taxpayers Federation. She says peculiarities in Illinois sales tax law force the Department of Revenue to write rules about where sales take place.
And in some instances, it led to some rather unexpected results.
Meaning, some companies have been able to run their businesses in one place, like Chicago, but for tax purposes, book their sales someplace with a lower rate, like Kankakee. In some cases, it's consultants like MTS that book the sales. Plus, under state law, Kankakee gets a penny of the sales tax it collects, and it gives 85% of that back to these companies. The remaining sliver adds up to $2.5 million a year for Kankakee, 10% of the village's budget.
That really isn't any different from the income tax credits or the property tax abatements that we're giving people to come here.
For instance, Boeing got tens of millions of dollars in city and state tax breaks when it moved its headquarters from Seattle to Chicago in 2001. Jordan Matches is chief of staff for the RTA. He's suing companies like MTS and towns like Kankakee. He says there are reasons companies base their operations in Chicago. Amenities like transit make it easier for them to do business.
And if they want to move somewhere else that has less resources, that's their decision. But as long as they're taking advantage of all our government services, they need to be paying the appropriate sales tax.
Kankakee's mayor, Nina Epstein, makes no apologies.
I mean, there are other parts of the state other than the RTA district. You know, there is other parts of Illinois.
She says some of these companies don't have Chicago offices at all. They're internet companies. They don't need full-time staff to fulfill orders.
This has helped fund police and fire services, public works, but now it's going to be taken away.
Last fall, the Illinois Supreme Court ordered a rewrite of tax regulation to eliminate some of these arrangements, and that's underway. Meanwhile, some companies have ended their presence in Kankakee, and Epstein has zeroed out income from these tax deals in her next budget. Tax expert Carol Portman says this is how tax policy works. There are winners and losers.
It's easy for someone like the RTA to feel like they've been the loser and they want changes that make them the winner. But the problem is there's a loser then.
In Kankakee, Illinois, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Back in 1995, a company that few of us had ever heard of released the first animated movie made entirely on a computer. It was a little film called Toy Story and a little company called Pixar. Rings a bell now, doesn't it? In the nearly 20 years since, Pixar has had what you might fairly call an enviable record of success. And one of the people responsible for that, he would probably say only in some small part, is the president of Pixar, Ed Catmull. Ed's written a new book that is a little bit the history of the company and a little bit catching lightning in a bottle, how they do what they do. It's called Creativity, Inc. Ed, it's great to have you on.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
The story probably to start with you and Pixar and Steve Jobs and all of that, is Toy Story. That's the movie, right?
Yes, that was the first one where we actually pulled it off.
Did you think it was making a movie, or were you seeing what cool stuff you could do with a computer, if that makes any sense?
Oh, to be very clear, our intent was to make a good movie. We had other people who would like to have made a movie who were competing with us at the time, really, and most of them were focusing on the technology. And I had learned long ago that it's not about the technology. We use the technology, we develop it, we love it. It's about the story. And if we ever get those two inverted, we would get screwed up. And I think it's the thing that helped us make Toy Story, which was the first movie made on a computer, to be as good as it was. We didn't get that backwards.
It was not, though, this process of making Toy Story a resounding success. It was not without some really big setbacks, one of which was, and it comes out in the book pretty clearly, you were going to make Woody a mean guy. Woody, the hero of this thing, was going to be mean.
Right.
How do you do that to Woody?
He was mean. Well, we were discovering. And at the time, we were trying to figure out how to have a better process. But he was mean. The thing that we learned, though, is that every one of our films, when we start off, they suck.
Says the guy who's made I don't even know how many awesome movies.
What we've learned is that they all suck to begin with, but our job is to take it from something that sucks to something that doesn't suck. That is the hard part.
You've been so successful at Pixar. So successful. And congratulations and all of that stuff. Have you been too successful? There's a great line in here about somebody saying, we ought to make a lousy movie just to lower the bar, just to reset the market. You know?
Yes. Well, the fact is we have made some lousy movies.
All right. Well, I wasn't going to say it, but Cars 2 and Monsters Universe?
No.
All right. What I mean is we've
had a lot of movies that have failed internally.
Yeah, but they never see the light of day, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And it happens a lot. Almost half of our movies have gone through complete restarts.
Give me an example of a movie where you guys rebooted. You started over. Pick one.
Okay. So with Ratatouille, we had this rat. The whole thing's an unlikely idea. He wants to be a chef. And he's working with this chef who used to be one of the best in France, and he'd gone downhill. So the movie was stuck because it was going back and forth between the rat and the chef. Whose story is it? And so when he did the reboot, we killed the chef. So the chef is now dead.
He does die in the movie, right? He dies in the beginning.
Yeah. So it answers the question, whose story is it?
Okay, which is great, but it's so tough to kill these characters you love. It's like editing a story around here, and you got this great piece of tape, and the editor says, you got to lose the tape. And you're like, no, I can't lose the tape. That's a great piece of tape. How do you kill the stuff you love?
Well, here's the trick, is in everything we do, there are things that we love. And sometimes the things that we love get us stuck. And it's only if we let go of some of those things that we free the movie up to become greater.
There's a corporate story question that I have to ask you, and that's the sale of Pixar to Disney back, what, 5-6 years ago now? For
eight years ago?
Wow.
Ago.
All right. 8 years ago for $7.5 billion. That shook things up big time in the movie industry and in animation. First of all, why did Steve Jobs, do you think, who owned Pixar at the time, why did he decide to do it?
Well, there are a couple of big reasons. One of them is, as we developed, we needed to have other kinds of resources in terms of marketing and so forth, because our deal with Disney was coming to an end. So we were going to change as a company. The other one was that Steve knew that he had cancer, but he didn't know what the long-term outcome would be. Now, he lived for several years past that, and he fought it. But he knew at that time there was risk. So Steve was trying to set up Apple for long-term success, his family, and for Pixar. And so that was part of his motivation.
I have to tell you, we had Bob Iger on the program, the chairman and CEO of Disney. We had him on about 5-6 years ago, and I asked him about the distribution deal that ABC had had with iTunes. And I said, how did that come about? And he said, Steve Jobs called, and we set it up. And I was like, that's it? He said, yeah, that was it. We had a phone call. It was the most amazing thing.
All right.
Because you remember how big a deal that was,
yes.
Right?
So
ABC content going on iTunes.
That was a critical deal for me personally.
Yeah.
So Steve met with Bob, and they hit it off like really well. I mean, they formed a really good bond with each other. At this point, nobody in television wanted any of their good programs to be released on iTunes. This concept of digital distribution was brand new, and people were afraid. So Bob and Steve agreed that they would run an experiment with Lost and with their other biggest show.
Well, it was Desperate Housewives.
Desperate Housewives.
Yeah.
But the point was, is they agreed, and the deal was struck, I think, within 10 days.
Yeah.
And that particular event is what convinced me Bob Iger is the right guy to go with.
There will be a whole array of Pixar groupies out there who will be annoyed with me if I don't ask you about the Pixar theory of life. Are you familiar with the Pixar theory of life? That all Pixar movies exist in one universe, and you can draw a straight line basically from Tangled all the way through Monsters Universe and all the rest of them.
Yes, I am familiar with that.
And true or not true?
Everything's interconnected.
There you go.
All right. That's the way life is.
Ed Catmull. His book is called Creativity, Inc. You know him from Pixar, you know him from Disney, you know him from a bunch of things. Ed, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, in which rumor, innuendo, and speculative reporting play a key role. You know how we in the financial press say from time to time that there is word of this big merger being negotiated, or that there are reports of that corporate acquisition in the works? Sometimes those stories pan out, sometimes they don't. And now, thanks to researchers at the University of Southern California and at the University of Michigan, there is a way to tell which deals are more likely to actually get done. Number one on the list, consider the source. Bloomberg has the most accurate reportage of mergers and acquisitions, an astounding 80% accuracy rate, which is phenomenal. The New York Times is number six on that list, behind, and you gotta love this, the New York Post. Also, the bigger the company in question, the less likely it is that the story will pan out. So caveat emptor, I think, is the message here. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Millie Jefferson, and Melissa Yeager-Miller. I am Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.